Tomorrow marks 2 decades since September 11th. 20 years later, we're still trying to wrap our heads around its impact. Today, we're going to look at a very specific piece of this story, one that's especially relevant in Michigan. And that's because Michigan is home to the largest population of Arab Americans in the U.S.
It's just ridiculous. You know, some of the stories and things that still happen to a lot of my friends who either look very Arab or have a very Arabic name or wear hijab.
Since 9/11, Arabs or Muslims, or even people perceived as Arab or Muslim, have experienced intensified policing and discrimination. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later on in the pod, we're going to take a look at how 9/11 impacted Dearborn. But first, a very personal take on the attacks.
New York is so diverse. I lived in Queens, so my neighborhood was Muslim, Christian, Hispanic, Black, Arab, white.
That's Zara Huber. She's a former radio journalist. Currently, she's working in advertising. She's also a podcaster and photographer. And at the time of September 11, 2001, she was living with her family in Queens.
You know, it felt very safe. I loved the diversity. I loved being around other Arabs as well. So it was a great vibe in New York City.
But that vibe changed pretty quickly after the attacks.
So to be honest, the city shut down for over a week. So no college, no trains, nothing. Our family did not leave the house for over a week. And then we heard horror stories about our friends and our friends' daughters or our friends' friends who were going out and were getting attacked, women who were being raped. So, of course, you know, the fear of even leaving the house at this point was growing. And so when the university finally opened back up, you know, I emailed the dean and I said, hey, you know, I'm a little bit afraid of coming back to campus. I'm hearing horror stories about things that are happening on some of these, you know, college campuses. And he said, don't worry, like if anything happens, we'll make sure to take care of it. You are in safe hands, et cetera. So they were very good. When I did finally leave, I know when I took the train, I noticed a lot more stares. People were moving away from me on the train when I got on it. People looked afraid of me. And I was this very skinny, like outspoken girl. And it felt so weird for people to be afraid of someone like me. And of course, you know, I would hear people mutter terrorist and go back home as I walked by. However, I did get, surprisingly, a lot of random people would come up to me and say, and I know it sounds weird, but they would come up to me and say, we know you're not a terrorist. We know these aren't people, you know, who you associate with, which sounds so strange for people to actually like want to come up and say that. But also it was almost like a breath of fresh air because everybody was labeling us as Muslims and us as Arabs as terrorists.
Yeah.
And then I also had more people come up to me and ask questions. You know, how do you feel about this attack? What are your thoughts on it? What are your thoughts on Al-Qaeda? What are your thoughts on, you know, terrorism? Tell me more about like what your religion practices and things like that. So it was actually like an opportunity for me to actually talk about, hey, we're a peaceful people. These are extremists and they have nothing to do with our religion. And so it was really mixed. Of course, you know, I was afraid. I didn't travel at certain times. I tried not to travel by myself, you know, for a few months after because of not just the horror stories I heard, but also some of the comments I got. You know, I heard some of my friends got their hijabs ripped off their head. I was just very aware of what my surroundings were at all times.
Zara, I mean, this is a lot. You were what, like 19, 20?
I was 18 at the time.
And instantly ambassador for the culture.
Yes. Yep. I mean, I always kind of felt like an ambassador for the culture just because of the scarf on my head. I feel like it's a beacon. But at this time, you know, a lot of the people who I was around had never had a chance to talk to a Muslim woman. So suddenly I'm the speaker of the whole entire Muslim Arab American population. And me myself, you know, I mean, I'm pretty liberal and, you know, I haven't like studied the religion. So like some of my answers, I'm like, I don't know, you know, I just know that, you know, these are extremists and we don't support this. But also I hated that I felt like I had to explain myself. You know, I had to say, oh, no, we don't support this. Oh, my God, I'm so sorry. Like, I didn't do this. You know, this wasn't something that I would condone. This isn't something that my religion is known for, really, within our religion. And so I found myself apologizing for the actions of these horrible human beings, you know, for, you know, victimizing the country. And it was a lot. It was a lot for a teenager.
Yeah. You came to Dearborn in 2002. That must have been a pretty big change for you also.
It was. It was a really big change. You know, Dearborn, as you know, has the highest Arab American population outside of the Middle East. And so when I came to Dearborn, there were no comments. Everybody wore hijab. It was very normal, no stares. But also I missed the New York atmosphere, because even though I was getting some of those comments from people that I probably wouldn't get in Dearborn, I didn't get a chance to kind of talk to people and explain, like, this isn't who we are, which really isn't, you know, I'm not saying that's my duty, but I loved having the chance to educate people about who we really are as a group of people. However, when I did leave the city of Dearborn, for instance, when I went to Birmingham or Somerset Mall at the time, it was very not diverse, is probably the best way to put it. And I got comments there. I got stares. I remember somebody in Birmingham, and I had stopped going to Birmingham after this. Some guy in Birmingham leaned out of his car when he saw me just walking down the street. And he leaned out of his car and went, "Galalalalalalalalalaboo." And I remember I was so hurt that day because, you know, that's what some people think about us. And it just, I stopped going there, and I didn't like it. You know, I just didn't like going home with that feeling.
Yeah. It's been 20 years this week, and I think that people who are Muslim might have, you know, some different things to say about the degree to which, you know, mainstream society considered a Muslim life a normal life before 9/11. Mm-hmm. But I just wonder what you think about how we're doing in Michigan with acceptance and with an understanding of all the things that you've been answering questions about your whole life.
I definitely think Michigan, because I like to travel, so I definitely see a difference like when I go to other states or even other countries. But I think Michigan definitely has some work to do in areas outside of the Metro Detroit area. I remember I went to like the Upper Peninsula once with my family, you know, who wore hijab, and there were a lot of comments, and somebody even refused to serve us. And this was like 4 years ago only. So I do feel like there's areas outside of Metro Detroit that need a little bit of work with just diversity in general, really, not even just as a Muslim or Arab American. But I do feel like Metro Detroit as a whole, there's a lot changing. You know, I do feel like we're moving forward. I do feel like people are more accepting and more understanding. And we can also thank media for that as well. You know, I feel like there's a lot more diversity, you know, in the media now than there was, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago. When I started my radio job in 2008, I was the only Muslim and Arab American in the entire building, and we had 5 stations. I mean, it took them forever to realize not to put pepperoni on a pizza for me. But I do feel like, you know, times have changed. I feel like there's more diversity, you know, everywhere you look. And so it is helpful. But I do feel like we have a long way to go.
In a minute, we talk about what was going on in Dearborn in the years following September 11th and how one community became a stand-in for what white America thought it knew about Muslims.
Support for the Stateside Podcast comes from the University of Michigan's Go Blue Guarantee, committed to keeping a U of M undergraduate education within reach of all Michigan residents, regardless of socioeconomic status. Programs are available for all 3 campuses. More at goblueguarantee.umich.edu.
Support for Michigan Public's Stateside Podcast comes from Lake Trust Credit Union, working to empower financial well-being for Michigan consumers, businesses, and communities. Committed to financial solutions and advice to support people and families. More information at laketrust.org.
Thank you. Ali Harb is a journalist. He lives in Washington, D.C. He was a kid living in Lebanon on September 11th. Just a few years later, his family came to Michigan, and Ali spent his teens and early 20s in Dearborn, observing people who bore the impact of post-September 11th bias. His first impressions of Dearborn weren't great.
Frankly, I didn't like it. I mean, you have a teenager transplanted, uprooted to a new culture, new language. High school here is brutal, and I had a lot of homesickness. I missed my friends. I missed my neighborhood, which is not uncommon for immigrants in general, especially at the age of teenagers, where you're not developed enough or mature enough to understand and take into effect the broader picture, yet you're not young enough to easily assimilate and forget.
Ali, you became a journalist, and you started a job at the Arab American News at Dearborn, and you were covering a fair amount of politics. What did you notice in, I guess, what we'd call the post-9/11 years, about how the political winds were shifting in Dearborn?
So the community had grown in size and number. The first story I wrote for the Arab American News was about a community event denouncing the Boston bombing. The event was attended by local officials, by local imams, and you could see that the community was emerging as a force. And also the same year that I started working at the Arab American News, 2013, Dearborn elected its first Arab American City Council president, who also happens to be a woman. And it was just a moment of jubilation for the community. In 1986, the late mayor Guido sent a flyer saying, let's talk about the Arab problem. He later really fixed his relationship with the community. He was mayor when I moved to Dearborn. And people loved him by the end of his tenure because he made an effort into fixing that relationship. But this flyer tells you about the history of Dearborn. So to go from that to 2013, the city elects its first Arab American City Council president. It just showed that Arab Americans are now a major force in the city, if not the major political force in the city.
In those earlier years after 9/11, though, when you were sort of finding your feet as a politics reporter, what did you observe of Dearborn's, national profile and the way it was talked about outside of Dearborn and indeed outside of Michigan?
So Dearborn is the boogeyman for the far right. You have people in this country who have been dealing conspiracy theories about demographic changes and about Muslims immigrating en masse to Europe and to the United States. And in their apocalyptic, unfounded theory, the Muslims would take over and declare Sharia law and subjugate everyone. So for this theory to work, you need a sort of microcosm to warn about. Like, look at this place. The rest of America will be like this place. In the early years, Dearborn was a perfect candidate. Because, you drive down Warren Avenue, Michigan Avenue, you see a lot of Arabic storefronts, you see a lot of bakeries, a lot of shawarma places, people dressed in a hijab or in a Muslim garb, and it's beautiful to see this amazing subculture of food and music and literature emerging and marrying Arab culture to American culture. But to the far right on the internet, Dearborn was this place where Sharia law is happening, where there are stonings and honor killings, where there, you know, women can't leave the house. It made it into the mainstream of the Republican Party. So you had Fox News with, you know, Jesse Waters came to Dearborn, did a segment once, you know, and it opened with sort of like Aladdin music in the background. And he interviewed somebody who said there was a stoning here last week. If you went into the social media posts of that particular segment, they were like, you know, let's get our AKs and go there. You know, let's go stop the Muslims. Let's bomb them before they bomb us. So it was interesting in that Dearborn became this very scary place in right-wing circles, but it couldn't be further from reality because the city itself is just a beautiful multicultural place.
Ali, it's easy to see how frustrating that would have been for anybody living in the city at the time. Were there ways that that kind of demonization affected life in town?
In town itself, it's, you know, life goes on as usual. One thing is you had to put a sheriff's car in front of the mosque. There were fears of, you know, what may happen. And this predates our robust understanding of right-wing militancy, of right-wing terrorism, and how dangerous it can be. But there were fears. There were fears. There were anxieties. Like, what happens if somebody, you know, carries an attack against us because of all this demonization? And the local politicians, the community, they tried to push back against it as much as possible. Mayor O'Reilly, who's still the current mayor, would, you know, issue a letter each time a segment misrepresenting or demonizing Dearborn comes out. The local politicians would issue statements. The community leaders would get together and do press conferences. But it never stopped. It just kept on coming.
One of the other things that changed for all of Michigan and all of the United States after September 11th was a much more robust conversation about safety and perceptions of safety. And all of a sudden, the phrase "see something, say something" got used a lot more frequently. And for some law enforcement, that meant if you are Muslim, it's your responsibility to keep an eye on things. And maybe if you saw something that resembled an extremist sentiment, to tell police about that. Was that top-down directive? Was that felt very much in Dearborn?
It was, and it wasn't, because there was an ongoing effort to streamline these kind of directives from the federal government to community leaders. There was an effort to create some sort of dialogue between federal officials, including law enforcement federal officials, we're talking DHS, FBI, and the local community. A lot of folks in the community saw this effort as, you know, euphemism for spying, basically. I don't see you going having meetings in Livonia or Novi. Why are you coming to Dearborn to have meetings? You're bringing a cloud of suspicion to us. Yet, many leaders in the community, including imams, including longtime activists, the older activists, they saw this effort to have dialogue with the federal government as a good thing, because it's a two-way street. Yeah, they come, they rely their messages, but we can also rely our grievances and our messages, the no-fly list, the endless random screening of Arab Americans at borders, at the border from Canada and the Detroit airport. So a lot of the younger activists, I would say, rejected this framing, rejected this relationship altogether. And the older, more old school activists and organizers wanted that dialogue with the government, wanted to be on the government's good side.
Were there ways in which you think the internal politics of Dearborn were affected by all this external pressure?
I would say no. I mean, I'm sure there was some effect. But the city local politics, it's mundane, April. I mean, Dearborn is just an amazing town. And if you look at it nationally, you have this Arab American community, Muslim American community that's thriving. But on a micro level, people are worried about picking up the trash and the length of the drive-throughs and, you know, the salt that's being purchased for next winter. So, yeah, there were tensions. These national tensions do play a role. If you look at the voting in the city, there is a clear racialized voting pattern. People on the east side that's heavily Arab American vote for Arab candidates. People on the west side are less likely to vote for Arab candidates. So these dynamics exist, but at the end of the day, what drives city politics is city local issues.
Are there things that you wish more people understood about life in Dearborn or about immigrant communities in Michigan more generally?
Yeah, I wish people did not look at immigrant communities, especially of Arab and Muslim backgrounds, as something special. That immigration story, the immigration patterns, it's the story of this nation from, you know, the 1700s. So communities, they come, they congregate, they create businesses, they evolve. And I hate how Dearborn is seen as this super exotic place. Like I said, it is exotic in terms of the food that it provides, but beyond that, it's just another town.
And that's the Stateside Podcast. I'm April Baer. You can find the full Stateside show at michiganradio.org. We have a lot more conversations to bring you. We hope you can hit the website and listen in full. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Today's podcast was produced by Rachel Ishikawa, April Van Buren, and Mike Blank. Our theme music is by 14KT, additional music from Blue Dot Sessions. Thank you so much for listening. Have a safe weekend. We'll see you on Monday.